today's speakers, I'd like to introduce Jacob Stahl and Morty Searle, Douglas and Clifton attorneys. They're here to talk about a very interesting case that they worked on involving a Chicago dentist that disinherited any children that would marry outside the Jewish faith in the subsequent litigation over the validity of the woman. Jacob and Morty.
Okay, thank you very much, Daniel. I have to say it's very exciting to be here.
Yes, I forgot, but you're about to get to it. Morty Searle, most of you are not aware, but he was the previous head of Columbus, so
to be here on this side of the table, speaking after the introduction, is very exciting to me personally. As Daniel mentioned, Jacob Stahl and myself are here to talk about an amicus brief, which we were fortunate enough to have worked on. It was filed earlier this year in the Illinois Supreme Court. I'll be giving, just by way of a roadmap, I'll be giving the introduction, the roadmap of the case, the facts, how it came to us, what the interests of our clients are, and some of the technical trust and state arguments that we advanced in the brief. And then Jacob will be taking over to discuss some of the religious freedom arguments that were in. Please feel free to interrupt this question. The problem is I'm just one quick question. Please feel free in the middle of this question. Turn off the time afterwards. So basically, this case started with Max Feinberg, who was, as Daniel said, was a dentist in Chicago. He was married to Erla, Max and Erla Feinberg. They had two children, Lila and Michael. Between the two children, there was five grandchildren. One of them was Michelle, who was a party in this case. Now, Max, part of the estate plan, he executed a will, and in that will was poured over into a trust, which basically means that everything that he has upon his death goes into this trust, which continues after his death. And this trust was for the benefit of his wife, Erla, and she had a limited power of appointment over the trust assets, which means that she has the ability to take the money out of the trust and give it to whoever she wants within a previously designated class of people who over here happen to be the descendants of Max, her husband. So she could take, there was somewhere between $1 and $2 million in trust that was there on her death. She had the ability at any time to distribute that money to any of her children or grandchildren. Now, Max, when he executed this will and did this trust, he included a clause in there, which is the clause which is not under discussion, but it's the clause which is similar to what the case deals with, but it's the clause which said that a descendant of mine, other than a child of mine, who married outside the Jewish faith, for instance, unless the spouse of such a descendant is converted or converts within 1 year of the marriage to the Jewish faith, and his or her descendant shall be deemed to be deceased for all purposes of this instrument as of the date of such marriage. So in other words, if any of his descendants who are takers under the trust will marry outside the Jewish faith, they'll be considered dead. And there's an exception if they marry someone out of faith, but that person converts within 1 year, then they'll still be able to take money under this will and trust. Now, Erla, Max died in 1986. Erla, she died in 2003. But before she died, she executed this limit. She exercised her limited power of appointment she said that I'm going to take money out of trust, $250,000 for each of my descendants who are not deemed deceased. So basically, she left money to each of her children and grandchildren who are not considered deemed deceased under her husband's estate plan, which was basically incorporating this clause. So it's a little bit, when all the media and when people describe this case, they say it's really Max's, they describe it as being Chicago dentist that wrote this clause into his will. In reality, what we're dealing with is Erla's power of appointment. When she gave this gift with this condition that the children can't be deemed deceased, it was really her actions that this case revolved around, and not Max's clause that he wrote in 1986, that he wrote in before his death. So that's just a little bit of clerical confusion that might see in some articles or whatnot. So basically, she died in 2003. Her children, Michael and Lila, they were appointed executors of her estate and her husband Max's estate. Now, between them, they had five grandchildren. Four out of five of these grandchildren had married non-Jews. They were married outside the faith, and they were all married for a year before Lila died. So it was all clear upon her death that all of them are deemed deceased under the trust, under her power of appointment. Now, actually, this case, I mean, it's a whole soap opera. This Supreme Court case in our brief deals with a very narrow issue, whether this clause is valid as public policy under the law. But it really started, this case started because there was allegations of fraud by one of the granddaughters, Michelle, who was the other party. She sued her father and her aunt, saying that they were cheating with taxes, they were stealing money from the estate. That's the real background on this. And then her father and her aunt, the executors, came into court and said, listen, whether it's true or not what we did, you have no standing here because you are not a taker under this will because you married out of the religion. You're deemed deceased. And then they brought this motion. Michelle, the granddaughter, came in and said, there might be a clause like that, but the court should invalidate that as being against public policy. And because it's Jacob's going to speak a little more about, but basically it restricts her right to marriage and Illinois public policy doesn't include that. But, and the lower courts actually agreed with her, the trial court, and then it was appealed to the appellate court, and they actually agreed with her arguments, and they invalidated this clause, and therefore she had standing to bring the suits of alleging fraud against her executors, her parents, her father, and all that. Now, but I mean, there's a whole nother soap opera that's going on. We really don't understand all the facts about the case, and it really wasn't important for us to read it. But that's the little bit of that. And I mean, as a side note, some commentators have noted that this $250,000 per kid. Which ends up for a grandchild, which ends up being $1.25 million, which she was trying in some way to honor people that her descendants that didn't intermarry. If she would have just used that money to provide an education, Jewish values, or some sort of Jewish education, which from the record is clear that these grandchildren really did not have, she would have probably had a much higher success rate of people of marrying within faith instead of the 80% failure rate that she has now. And that's not just a comment, but there's empirical data, the surveys which show that there's a direct relationship between the level of education, Jewish education, and education in Jewish values and ideals. It's directly connected to the rate of intermarriage that will occur with children that receive education or don't receive education. So moving back to our case, this case started generating a lot of publicity, both in the Illinois media, but I think it was an article in the Chicago Tribune, and it was picked up by the AP, and also the Chicago Bar. There was symposiums at law schools in Illinois, and people were getting very excited and heated about this case. And a prime reason behind this is because there was some very strong language in the opinions in the appellate court. It was actually three opinions. There was the majority concurring and the dissent. And again, the majority had agreed with the granddaughter to invalidate the clause. Jacob can talk more about this, but the concurring opinion, Justice Quinn, who I'm not going to mention more about what we thought about his opinions, but he said that he equated intermarriage, not very explicitly, but his words were that if we uphold this clause, it would lead to the worst type of bigotry imaginable. Which we obviously think that encouraging children to marry within the faith is not real, it has no relation at all to that type of statement, and that's something which we spent a lot of time in the brief dealing with, trying to show incorrect in the statement. And so that got people excited that complaint. And also, there was a dissent by Justice Freeman, who was fired. And apparently, he's a very active Jewish, Jewish bar-related activities. And he wrote a very passionate opinion where he said that Max was just trying to defend 4,000-year-old Jewish faith, and some very poetic language. So this got people very excited, and it came to the attention of our clients. Now, a little bit of a word about our clients. Our clients were actually three clients. The Agudas Israel of America, National Council of Israel, and the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America. Now, the Agudas Israel is a very long-standing full-blown client of them. The other two organizations were, this is the first time we worked with them, but they were great in terms of support. We needed a lot of information from them, especially because just to get admitted to file our brief was not simple. I don't know if we're going to get to that, but basically the court didn't want to let us in, and we had to file a whole lot of motion. I'm not sure why. It seems like you can't track the amicus briefs are allowed in. For some reason, they didn't want to have our opinion. But anyways, They were great to work with. And they saw this. I mean, in general, intermarriage is decimating it's the largest threat to the survival of Jewish people. I'm going to go through a little later the demographics of intermarriage and assimilation. And it's frightening. And these organizations, between them, I would say probably 90% of Orthodox Jews belong in some way or are serviced by one of these three organizations. And they view this as intermarriage as a tremendous threat to the continuity of the Jewish people. And they saw this as one way that a grandfather or a father or any testator would try to encourage his children to marry from the faith. And they felt that it would be in the best interest of their constituents to have an amicus brief filed, and also we'd be able to bring to the table as Orthodox organizations that represent Orthodox Jews the view of why marriage in faith is so important.
Can I just jump in for one second? None of these organizations are necessarily endorsing or not endorsing the particular practice in question. That's a religious issue. Our point is simply that this person thought it was important as part of their Jewish observance to do it. We're going to back them up without making any endorsement or lack thereof of the particular practice. That this is, in fact, you know, a cogent way to use this practice. I think Morty may talk a little about sort of religious debate back and forth about this particular practice. That sort of wasn't the point of bringing up that thing.
That's right. And additionally, obviously, we have no best interest in the actual outcome in the case. In terms of what we were talking about before, in terms of the fraud and that issue, we were just solely wanted this issue about the public policy of a clause such as this. And as a matter of fact, even though we subsequently, the court agreed with some of our arguments and they overruled the lower courts, the Supreme Court overruled the lower courts, they sent it back down to the lower courts and remanded. So it could end up being that the granddaughter wins against her parents. But that wasn't what our interest in this was.
Is there a charitable remainder?
I don't think so. I'm
just curious if there are any Jewish organizations.
No, I think it went solely, his trust went solely to his wife, and then upon her death it was to be distributed. Different ways of considering to the descendants. I don't think there was any question about charity.
Would that have changed it?
I don't think so. I think what you're trying to get at is that maybe they would have had some sort of vested interest that they would have been part of the case.
Possibly. Maybe the state would have had a right to be a party.
It must not have been because we didn't.
No, it was just straight within the family. There was, it didn't go anywhere else.
So these three organizations, this case came to their attention. They came to us and they asked us to write an amicus brief. And now, I must put in a plug for them because I feel incredibly grateful that they took this on. It was myself, Jacob, counsel and trustees police, so a partner in trustees police, and another litigation partner that worked on this time. I know just for my billing, it took up for 6 weeks of time, it took up approximately 70% of my cost. And I mean that says a lot about veterans. And not only that, it was tremendously interesting. This was one of the first projects I was able to do when I came to the firm. And I mean this type of clause is something, I mean if you take Professor Newman's class, this is in the textbook. The Shapiro case, this exact type of clause, this is disinheriting children that marry outside the city. This was a textbook case and it was something that I got to work on. And also part of my job, I was tasked with investigating the Jewish law aspects of this case, which as I mentioned, part of our argument would be to show that this was something which for the Jewish interest in. So that was, it was my, and in that regard, I really was able to set me up with a rabbi who, and I was able to learn the Jewish law of this while filling the time at that point. And, another aspect was that I looked into the demographics of all the research in terms of the statistics of it, which was also, I mean, like I said, it was frightening, but it was also very interesting. So I'm going to speak about the Jewish law aspect. Before hearing the monetary demographics, then I'm going to talk about untrusted disregard, and then I'll end it over to Jacob. So first, I mean, it's clear in Jewish law that intermarriage is not allowed. And not only that, but it's one of the most serious things that in terms of Jewish identity and what people look at it as the practice of Judaism. This is like one of the worst things that could possibly be. And it's one of the commandments in the Bible not to intermarry. And it goes back to Abraham. When Abraham was looking for a wife for his son, Jacob, he was very particular about choosing her from his family. So not only that, but this case didn't just implicate intermarriage, it also implicated another pillar of Judaism, education of children. Because over here we have the way we looked at it initially was that Max was trying to educate his children to not intermarry. So education, and as a matter of fact, the way that the Torah, the Bible, frames intermarriage, it frames it in this context. It says, don't let your children intermarry because then they will move away further from Judaism. So the same two issues that you dealt with over here, the right to educate children marrying within the faith is the same exact way that the Torah frames it, the Bible frames it, which I thought was uncanny.
That's a cool question about education.
Yeah.
How widely did we advertise this children's rich?
So that's a very good question. It ended up that that we didn't include self education arguments. We Jacob will talk more about it. But it turns out that from the record it's very unclear how much notice they had of this clause. And arguably, the way that the Supreme Court ended up looking at it was that they actually mentioned that the kids didn't have a right to notice this. So we ended up concentrating more on Max's, he wanted his intention was to honor and further those children that followed in his footsteps, not necessarily as a punishment for the children that did it at intermarry, but as a way to use his money to further people that those of his descendants which are continuing his ideals.
So it wouldn't really be educating any of the existing ones at the time.
That's 100%.
At least it's very unclear. You know, the whole nature of his Max's individual religious service is very unclear from the record. People we talked to said, well, maybe he's a member of an Orthodox synagogue. I think somebody said, oh, he's a conservative synagogue. So it's not really clear exactly, you know, if he sort of, you know, how deeply he, you know, what exactly he believed. I mean, we know that he felt very strongly about Jewish continuity, but did he ever actually express that to anybody is very unclear at best.
Yeah. I mean, we thought for sure he had spoken to his grandchildren about this is all speculation on our part, because, like you said, this is a family fight, and nobody's going to say anything which is really very truthful. That doesn't further their own interests.
And ultimately, it doesn't matter what, doesn't really. The fact is, we felt that he did this for a religious reason, and, you know, exactly, you know, was it the best religious reason, you know, how much you really care about it is not sort of the key to the argument. You know, assuming this, you know, this was a religiously motivated act, you know, how does the law look at it? Because in this particular case, of course, it's very hard to tell.
Yeah. That's a very good question. So that was the Jewish law that I opened to, and we ended up incorporating just the intermarriage aspects of that in the Greek, not the education part. And then moving on to the demographics of intermarriage, to what it's doing to Jewish people, I'm just gonna quote from the Greek some of the statistics that I came upon. Basically from 1990 to 2005, the Jewish population in America dropped by 4%, from 5.28 million, even though there was an influx of 200,000 Jewish immigrants. So even though there was 200,000 absolute people coming in, more Jews coming to America, and the general U.S. population grew by 8%, the Jewish population dropped by 4%. And that was, I mean, I don't know exactly why.
Break down there as to how many males marry out of their religion as opposed to females.
No, I didn't see anything about that.
The Jewish organizations never talk about it.
I didn't see anything about this. That's an interesting point.
It wouldn't really matter so much if a woman, I mean, obviously it does religiously, but technically, if a woman marries out of faith, it doesn't matter, the children still do it. So the males that marry out of faith are the ones that really cause the problem, because their children won't be Jewish.
Well, that's true, but not true. Trying to educate your children that to follow in the footsteps of the religion, you would imagine Judaism is the patriarchal religion and the most contiguous with the Jewish language.
Well, let me just interject. The surveys that we looked at, they're not conducted by us, but for the most part, by Orthodox organizations. And one of the main, I mean, all these surveys come with a tremendous amount of introduction about, because they implicate what is a Jew. If you're going to measure Jews in America, it's going to get put into the question, which I don't want to deal with. But, I mean, just from these numbers, I think they all took the most inclusive view of what a Jewish person is. And still, they came up with this, with these very scary statistics about intermarriage. And of Jews who married between 1985 and 2001, more than half of those marriages over that time period or intermarriage, compared with the 6% rate of intermarriage from 1941 to 1960. So, also, in terms of what the effect that intermarriage has on Jewish children, the survey showed that children from intermarried parents are much less likely to identify as Jews and participate in the Jewish community. And approximately 1/3 of children from intermarried parents are being raised as Jews, compared to 96%. Of children whose parents are both of the Jewish faith. And finally, in terms of children from intermarriage, they're much more likely themselves to intermarry. 3 out of 4 children of these intermarriage couples are likely to marry themselves, opposed to 22% from who have 2 Jewish parents. And just one startling statistic, which we didn't include in brief, is that among American Jews, according to a 1990 survey, more American Jews have Christmas trees than light shops. So at any rate, that was some of the background that the research that was done on the case. And then in the brief, one of the Justice Case arguments was some of the cases that had been relied upon by Michelle, who's the granddaughter, who had argued to void the clause, was that this was an exercise of dead hand. So basically, her grandmother, her grandfather, had included this clause, and what it was going to do is that it was going to limit her prospectively to what she could, who she could marry. And there was a policy against dead hand. And basically, we argued that it was a mistake, because the way that I explained before that really the issue was not Max's will or the grandfather's trust, the grandfather's will. The issue was the grandmother's power of appointment, her gift upon her death of $250,000 for each kid. And at her death, all the children had been married, and either were deemed deceased or not deemed deceased, and all the money, it was nothing that the grandchildren could have done prospectively could have changed the result of those gifts. And that's something that we argue in brief, and ultimately the Supreme Court picked up as the winning argument now in the
order. So just want to talk a little bit more sort of about what we wrote in the brief and sort of our purposes. Generally, when you're an amicus submitting a brief, you sort of pick up on sort of the issues that are important to your organization. We actually sort of overstepped that a little bit, I think partially because we just felt so strongly that some of the language is, well, first of all, sort of an abstract level, sort of just the notion, essentially, a person ordering their private affairs according to religious values is somehow wrong, essentially just distributing their own money, struck us as, you know, somewhat abhorrent, and the language got quite heated, and I think we just felt very strongly that this decision needed to be overturned. So the party nominally aligned with us, of course, just has the interest of winning the case. We're trying to, you know, set forth sort of our view of the world. And so doing that, we sort of took a wide swath sort of attack on sort of the religious freedom issues, but other issues as well, just because, like, we really wanted to just sort of get what we thought was sort of a well-thought-out position on, you know, all the reasons that this case should be overturned. We sort of focused, besides the trust of the state's argument, on sort of two sort of conceptual issues. Issue number one is, what is the public policy of the state of Illinois? And issue two is, well, let's say that the public policy of Illinois is not what we advocated, but in fact that this kind of provision is invalid. You know, can that withstand muster? Could the court adopt such a public policy? And I'll sort of take you through both of the arguments that we make. So first of all, like, the question is, well, what is public policy? And the Illinois Supreme Court is pretty clear about that. It says you look to the Constitution, the statutes, and when they're silent, judicial decisions. So the question, you know, sort of addressed was, well, if you have one of these clauses basically rewarding somebody for not intermarrying, you know, does Illinois public policy permit this? So the first issue you have to look at is freedom of cessation. In every common law jurisdiction, freedom of cessation is quite broad. More or less, you can do whatever you want with your money. Not surprising. There are a few exceptions. The closest one that sort of hits on our facts is there were three decisions from the Illinois Supreme Court saying you can't discourage divorce. You cannot encourage divorce. You know, I will give you money after I die if you get divorced and so and so. There have been a few cases over time. These cases are, this is considered not promising. The lower courts tried to say, well, encouraging divorce and, you know, sort of putting what were known as sort of partial restraints on marriage, basically saying, you know, you can get this money, you can marry so-and-so, but not so-and-so, were the same thing. Of course, they're not the same thing. There was a little bit of dicta from 100 years ago that talked about the marriage context. So these decisions are very specifically about encouraging divorce. And anybody who's ever, like, worked in a divorce court can tell you that the state has a real interest in not encouraging divorce because you wind up with cost of litigation, ruined homes, and none of this applies to marriage where, first of all, you know, they were talking about restricting somebody's ability to marry. In fact, this case had nothing to do with restricting somebody's right to marry, because you can obviously marry whomever you want. You may have to deal with the financial consequences of that, but that's not really the issue. And you're not trying to break up a marriage, you're just trying to say, you know, I'll give you money if you take on this position in this religion and not, or marry somebody of this religion and not another religion. In fact, we actually saw demographic data suggesting that this actually would discourage divorce because the rates of divorce on average tend to be somewhat higher amongst intermarried families than intramarried families.
85% and this holds across not just Jewish intermarriage, but other
religions. Now, it turns out the second restatement I don't remember which one exactly, said that these types of provisions are explicitly permissible. That restatement came out in 1959. There's a much more recent third restatement of trust, which I think is less than 10 years old. It comes out exactly the opposite way, which says these things are not permissible. But when they say it's not permissible, basically they just cite public policy arguments without any citation to any case law, because in fact there is no case law on point that supports the position of the third restatement. In fact, the only case that's ever been located where a court said that this kind of clause is not permissible is from 1854. Then it dealt with a very particular set of facts, where basically somebody said, I'm only giving you this money if you marry a Quaker within some city, and there weren't very many Quakers there. And this basically became what was known as a form of restraint on marriage. Obviously, again, not truly a restraint, but sort of the point is, if you limit, you know, somebody to marrying one people or a handful of people, that's considered, like, beyond the line, whereas that bears sort of no relationship to marrying, you know, Jews, which there are, you know, many. So there's really, there's, like, literally not a single case on it. And the third restatement was basically just advocating their own view, and that's not really the view of restatements in any case. Restatements, we argue, you know, they reflect what the law is, not sort of, you know, their personal views of what it should be, and, you know, the court could adopt the restatement that they so chose, but then they'd just be adopting new arguments. The mere fact that it's called a restatement, said, you know, didn't really bear much muster. So we thought that, you know, just as a matter of freedom of testation, your money, you can do with it what you want. This had no relationship to any of the prior cases. And as such, we thought that would reason enough to let the clause in. The second reason that we thought Illinois public policy favored this kind of provision is because, in fact, Illinois public policy favors religious expression. Of course, you have the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, which, you know, generally has a free exercise clause. The Illinois Constitution has its own free exercise clause. In addition, there's actually Illinois statutory language that favors freedom of religion. It's known as the Illinois Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Some of you may have heard about this in the context of constitutional law, but for those of you who haven't, the United States Supreme Court, 15, 20 years ago, issued a decision called Employment Division versus Smith. And in Smith, the court said that if you have a law of general applicability, if it happens to burden religion, that, you know, that law is enforceable. Previously, it had been thought that if religion was substantially burdened, the government would have to meet a strict scrutiny test, which basically means it's a compelling government interest, and whatever was being done, sort of the least restrictive means was which they could do that. For the government to meet a compelling interest test is very hard, to sort of meet the standards of Smith is very low. Congress went ahead and passed something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that basically tried to return the compelling interest test. However, the Supreme Court said, vis-a-vis the states, that was unconstitutional. So many states went ahead and passed their own version of these laws that would, of course, only apply to state matters, basically saying, you were evaluating the burden. If something substantially burdens religion, you have to meet strict scrutiny. In other words, creating quite a high presumption in favor of the free religious exercise. We said, well, you know, Illinois passed one of these statutes, and it's very strong evidence that Illinois, in fact, supports the free practice of religion. So basically, in total, between, you know, sort of very strong public policies in favor of freedom of testation and strong public policies in favor of freedom of religion, between one or two or both of them, like, that really should end the case, you know, end of story. However, we recognize that, you know, given the influence that these statements do have, you know, the court may decide, you know what, even if they're misreading the old cases and so forth, we're enacting a new public policy. And that new public policy would say that these provisions are not. So we tried to deal with two arguments against that. And I have to say these arguments are somewhat novel. I don't think anybody's ever really tried to make them before. But we thought we might as well at least take a shot at it. The first argument is that this kind of a clause actually would violate the United States Constitution. So first of all, as a matter of constitutional law, common law decisions actually can violate the Constitution. There is Supreme Court decisions that say exactly this. And it's true that Smith, you know, gives the government a lot of leeway in sort of incidentally impacting upon religious practice. But the one thing they can't do is specifically target religious practice because it's religious practice. Some even constitutional law may be familiar with the Lacuna case, where a city in Florida basically tried to outlaw animal sacrifices from this particular church. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. Because what they were basically doing is specifically trying to outlaw one particular practice. The law had no sort of secular intent because you could kill a mouse because it was in your house and it was annoying, and that was perfectly okay, but if you were killing the same animal in sort of the religious context, that wasn't okay. And just very narrowly target religion is something you can't do. Similarly, some of you may be familiar with the case had to fly in New Jersey when they put up an Eruv. And the issue was this religious targeting? And the court again found it was because they basically, the argument of the city was, well, you can't put things that are telephone poles. The problem is when people put up, like, banners on their telephone poles for some secular purpose, that was considered okay. But to do the same thing for religious purposes is considered not okay. So our argument was basically, this would basically be a form of targeting religion. Because if you look at the way the 30 statement was written, it dealt, the only kind of thing it actually tried to outlaw was sort of a partial restraint based on religious motivations. There were other reasons that people might want to restrain marriage in sort of similar ways. It might have secular motivations, and those were, this was very directly targeted at sort of religious practice. And if so, this is basically just another form of religion targeting. And if so, then you sort of set the standard again, which is a strict scrutiny test. And these arguments fail, because one of the things you have to show is that, you know, this compelling government interest. But if the compelling government interest is in sort of, you know, keeping people out of, encouraging people to marry one way or the other, well, that's nonsense. Because, in fact, there are many, many ways you can encourage somebody to marry or not to marry anybody of your choice. You can say to somebody, I'll give you a lot of money if you marry a Jew, and I will give you a penny if you marry a non-Jew. You can write somebody out of your will for any old reason you choose. And so forth. So that was sort of our argument that this is sort of religious targeting with no government purpose, and thus it wouldn't withstand constitutional muster. Basically, the Illinois Religious Freedom Restoration Act also, we argued that it also sets up the same strict scrutiny test. It would also apply to common law decisions, and for the same reasons it would fail. And sort of the final point that we address is an establishment clause issue. Michelle had argued in her brief that the Establishment Clause prohibits the government from enforcing this kind of a religiously motivated instrument. And she cited the case of Shelley v. Kramer, the 1949 case where basically the Supreme Court was asked whether about the enforcement of a racial covenant in the housing context, and the Supreme Court said, you know, we can't enforce this because this would be state action. In fact, this language was picked up on, Shelley was actually cited in the concurring opinion, right in the context of this discussion of these kinds of provisions being, quote, the worst bigotry imaginable. So we thought this was an important argument to say that this has nothing to do with state action. And
sure. To those lines, how is the government determining who is a Jew? If it says, if you marry outside the faith, you're dead, well, doesn't that require the judge to play, the court, I'm sorry, the government to play rabbi in determining who's a judge?
That's a very interesting question. That's, I think, it was basically stipulated in these cases that these people were not Jewish.
Right.
If they had simply said, I'm a Jew,
right,
I think this case goes the other way. Because, in fact, there's known as the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine, which is basically the government that really truly has no choice, will not make those kinds of decisions.
Right.
Actually, one of the grandchildren came pretty close to saying just that in the deposition. They sort of said, well, you know, I don't know what it means to be a Jew. My husband, you know, gives charity like a Jew, and he does this like a Jew. We were married by a rabbi. If they'd actually said that, I think,
yes. Yeah.
I think the case goes the other way. I really do, because
the court of the opinion actually said you don't have to deal with Israel.
So they made sort of a, either because they truly didn't believe that they were Jews or, you know, weren't that clever, I don't know, but I think that ends the case. So in any case, the problem with this citation to Shelley v. Kramer is it's been pretty well decided that Shelley v. Kramer came out the wrong way. The Supreme Court in that case was very concerned about, you know, sort of enforcing racial bigotry, and it really stretched the bounds to state action, because in fact, enforcing a private arrangement is not state action. And Shelley has really only been applied in the racial context, and that's it. And that's one of the things we argue. Just sort of a note before I talk about the actual decision of the Supreme Court. I've already mentioned very briefly, after we filed this amicus brief, you don't get to file an amicus as a matter of right. It's a matter of the court's discretion. Turns out that the Illinois Supreme Court is somewhat strict about who they accept the amicus briefs. Michelle submitted a brief, basically, which boiled down to basically saying, who are these parties? We don't know who they are. We don't know if they're legitimate. And why are these New York Jews interfering in our court? And by the way, she strike all their arguments anyhow. So, and the Supreme Court actually granted this motion. We were sort of floored. And, you know, writing this took quite some time, and things that we just sort of being tossed out the window was, you know, a little bit more than depressing. And then we actually went back and submitted affidavits from a variety of organizations saying, guess what, we've submitted, you know, hundreds of amicus briefs, at least tens of amicus briefs to institutions including the United States Supreme Court, never once been denied. We actually found out that there had been sort of a religiously minded dispute the previous year in Illinois where I think it had something to do with abortion or something along those lines. So, of course, you had groups like the ACLU weighing in on one side and Christian groups on the other. And the Supreme Court took the amicus briefs in that case. Thankfully.
Worst case, if they wouldn't have granted you to file it, couldn't you have just handed the brief over to the parties that were fighting? The people who didn't want it to go to the intermarriage party?
We could have. I mean, you could have done something like that, but the thing to keep in mind is they're not religious freedom advocates. They in fact never addressed religious freedom in any of the cases. When they finally got to the Supreme Court after reading our brief, they threw in a few religious arguments, which is really a little deep. In the game is sort of a general principle of appellate law is you have to raise it at the district court first, which is why a lot of, basically all our religious arguments essentially in court are simply ignored for the simple reason they were never raised below. So yes, we could have done that, but first of all, there's no guarantee that you know, they would have wanted to take them, and second of all, there's also something of a concern about when you're advocates, you don't necessarily want to work too closely with the party whose interests you're aligned with because you're not part of it. Like, we truthfully didn't care where the money went. Like, if it went to one part or the other party of the state of Israel, like, it wasn't really our issue. So yeah, you could have done that, but it wouldn't have, it's not something I think we probably would have done. In any case, the Illinois Supreme Court issued its decision a couple months ago now. They overturned the lower court's decision. They actually focused, like Morty said, on this, the way she set up this power. But,
did you guys show up for oral arguments?
No. Amicus are not allowed to argue in Illinois. Somebody from one of the organizations, I think, went and sat in the audience, but none of us actually went. And basically what they said was, you know, based on the very narrow facts here, because she basically appointed the money at the time of her death, even this 30 statement didn't apply. There was no dead-handed control. And, you know, she could have, with her grandchildren, done whatever she wanted. She just said, you know, John was the one who didn't intermarry, gets all the money, she could have done that and excluded everybody else. So on these sort of very narrow facts, freedom of cessation applied, did not address any other issues, which is not surprising as Supreme Courts generally tend to address sort of the most narrow construction they could find. And I think significantly for us, they lifted exactly the argument on the establishment clause and said, yes, look, the shale of your favorite doesn't apply here, which I think is very significant for more than just this case because it would have been very bad if they started saying that sort of people organizing their own private affairs, you know, through private contracts or trusts or what have you, you know, that created state action. I think that could have created a horrific precedent, but thankfully they didn't. So that's basically what the Supreme Court argued. For our clients, we're, of course, very happy with this. Sort of put to bed two very bad decisions below. That's about it. And if you guys have any questions, I'm happy to.
Very well, I don't, maybe this is something that we're not allowed to spend billing time at the Court of American Court, but did you look at how, you know, in fact, there's significant Jewish community, these things must come up as well.
This issue has been raised from time to time in various courts, actually not always with Jews. They've always been upheld when they've been addressed. And in fact, you look at all the treatises that they say these provisions are fine. They're not litigated that much, I think, because it's basis of black letter law. Common law jurisdictions, these things are okay.
Okay, I meant like other countries.
Oh, other countries, yeah. That I couldn't speak to.
And besides for Jewish law, we don't
look
at any other jurisdictions.
This probably just goes to my lack of knowledge about most of the customs and things like that, but what would have happened if all the defendants had intermarried?
So basically, because the executors who are the middle generation, Michael and Lula, the parents, their kids don't get, they would go back to their parents. Under this clause, that's how it works. So basically, that's why it was such a family fight. It wasn't fair, because if their children, if the grandchildren don't get the money, basically, the people that are fighting the executors, her parents, stand the game. She's cut out, her share is $50,000 goes to the father. That was part of, I would imagine that's part of all the tension that's going on.
Did any churches show interest in this case? Like, you think the Catholic Church might have an interest in seeing this case, right?
You know, we talked at one point about trying to get other organizations involved. We didn't, I don't remember why. It may have just been... I mean, like, I don't know, like, looking back, like, I don't know if you, like, we're under a lot of time, like, if we had a lot of time in the world, we might have actually thought about it, but I have no idea, like, how the, for example, we would feel about aligning exactly like this with the Catholic Church, or, I don't know, although it's interestingly, like, a lot of these cases that come up in time actually haven't been involved news at all, so I don't know, it is interesting to see, you know, if it sort of got picked up by any other religious organizations that we care about.
The way the case was decided, it seems that as you explained, that there was a surprising Supreme Court who's interested in narrowing the restriction. But it would seem that its effect on future cases would have have no effect on the religious values of the clause. They basically ignored all of the religious arguments and just took this technicality. But do you feel that they did that because of all your religious arguments, and then they did that because they agreed with you but didn't want to actually sign off on it, or do you think they just only agree with this technicality?
I think it's hard to know what they would have thought about everything else, because honestly, like, we threw in a lot of arguments that we just wanted to get out there. I think we're properly raised. It doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It's just they're not going to pay attention. And I think because under even taking Michelle's arguments at face value that the third statement applies, the statement is still, just the way it was played out, it was still basically totally validated. And sort of given, you know, sort of the hot nature of these kinds of religious views, they were not going to try to describe them like that. What they would do if you actually had somebody who, you know, just had a clause, you intermarry, you're not getting money, that person dies, 20 years later somebody intermarries and they get disinherited, who knows? I don't think they wanted to, you know, venture into that awful territory because they really had to.
And this technical argument was posed by you and your interest, or the...
Yeah.
So you,
but what I think the other party
said something similar,
because otherwise you would have won the case for them, their terms, for their reasons. It would have been.
But what, I mean, ultimately, we're happy because, as Jake said, we didn't want a precedent in any state that this type of clause would be found.
Right.
So
right.
We got what we wanted.
Interestingly, there actually are a handful of states where the legislatures have actually come and at least purportedly outlawed these types of things. This is Michelle's side. I don't know if they ever sort of seriously studied the statutes, and of course that would be a question if they'd actually be valid. But nobody ever really seems to have touched the issue except to say that they exist. I don't think there's any litigation under them. In any case, it doesn't really seem to look common law should be, so they're out.
Okay, thank you very much, Morty and Jacob. As I said, this was the last event for the semester. Finals time upon us. Good luck to everyone. I'd also like to wish congratulations to the Colleen, the secretary, Stephen Gorenstein. I don't think anyone's ever seen him this year. On the birthday baby boy this morning. So, and again, stay tuned. After finals, we'll be sending out emails for the spring. So thank you all for attending.